evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Our fellow Gambians' blood been shed, you know, by the authorities in power, you know, to come together as one people, you know, and fight together for justice, you know, and reconciliation in our country, and also to heal as a nation, you know, and because we are the citizens that need to build our country.
Victims of human rights violations protest in the Gambian capital, Banjul, Saturday.
The way to address the issue we really deal with serious government reforms in this country, including reforms of the judiciary, reforms of the institutions that deal with issues to do with corruption, law enforcement agencies, and so on.
Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema appoints Sulumesis Muchula as the acting director general of the Anti-Corruption Commission.
The sisterhood that we represent in carrying out our activities, it will galvanize their efforts in doing more than what we have been doing before, and it will take us to all the remotest parts of the communities to preach peace.
And a Cameroonian peace activist is a finalist for the United States Institute of Peace, a USIP Women Peace Building Award 2021. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In the Gambia, victims of human rights violations held a protest in the capital, Banjul, Saturday. Themed Never Again March, the protesters called on the authorities to hold accountable anybody who is responsible for the violations of human rights of any citizen of the West African country. They also demanded the full implementation of the report by the Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission, or TRRC. The commission was established in 2018 to examine the alleged abuses under former President Yahya Jammeh's 22-year rule. Some victims and alleged perpetrators testified during the commission's sitting about the alleged abuses that were carried out during the former president's long rule. Sharif Kijera is the head of the Gambian Center for Victims of Human Rights Violations. He tells me that the government must do more to hold accountable those responsible for committing human rights violations during former President Jammeh's rule to serve as a deterrent.
Well, for far too long, the victims have been standing on their own, and there was no such kind of support from the general public. I mean, with regards to addressing some of the issues and challenges that they are confronting, you know, in the transitional justice process. So the civil society, I mean, that came together and showed solidarity with the victims' community to march for never again, to impunity, and then never again not to go back to the old ways of doing things. It used to happen, in the Jammeh era. We need to reform our institutions, you know, both the security sector, civil service, and the rule of law institutions, and the entire governance architecture. So, basically, that is the essence of staging the march today.
Are you saying you are not pleased with how things are at the moment in terms of addressing impunity or alleged crimes committed during Yahya Jammeh's regime?
I'm looking at the current dispensation. With the president, you have he has surrounded himself with the former Yahya Jammeh enablers. They are still very powerful in government, and you have in the security sector perpetrators that are still within the security, you know, apparatus. You know, those that have committed, you know, human rights violations, they are still, you know, within the government structures. So I think there isn't much, you know, that has been addressed with regards to institutional reform.
Sharif, what do you make of former President Yahya Jammeh saying he is sorry for the first time in 27 years?
Well, basically those are crocodile trees. Well, for Yahya Jammeh, I mean, I think what he has to do, he has to properly address, I mean, the victims in a manner that is quite remorseful, that is quite apologetic. You know, he has to own up to his actions and recognize the fact that gruesome human rights violations were committed under his watch, orchestrated by himself, instructions given by himself to the junglers. You know, he has to, you know, acknowledge that fact, that all the evidence before the TRRC are actually, you know, the fact, you know, that is on the surface. So he has to own up to his responsibility, you know, to acknowledge, you know, the crimes that he has committed, and see, make an apology.
What is the overall statement following the demonstration or protest you held in Banjul Saturday?
Well, the purpose of the, of the march today is to raise awareness and to raise public confidence in the transitional justice processes. I mean, for people to take ownership of the transitional justice process, and to make the never again slogan, you know, a philosophy, a national philosophy, that each and every Gambian will, put nation first. You know, we will collectively hold our leaders accountable, you know, to show solidarity where, you know, the authorities are trying to, suppressed public freedom, you know, freedom of expression, you know, freedom of assembly, you know, and basically, is to promote the never again, that we will never go back to dictatorship, you know, never again to impunity. You know, nobody will support impunity in this country. You know, never again that we will watch our fellow Gambians' blood being shed, you know, by the authorities in power, you know, to come together as one people, you know, and fight together for justice, you know, and reconciliation in our country, and also to heal as a nation. You know, because we are the citizens that need to build our country.
Sherif Kijera is the head of the Gambian Center for Victims of Human Rights Violation. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. Meanwhile, in the Gambia, former President Yahya Jammeh says he does not support the alliance between his party and incumbent President Adama Barrow. He has since dissolved the leadership of the party. Speaking to his supporters from Equatorial Guinea, where he resides in exile, the former president announced interim leaders of his party, the Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC. He has since directed the new interim leadership to form an alliance with the Gunu Party, led by former Justice Minister Tijan Haidara. Meanwhile, local media reports the former president are saying he was sorry for things that happened during his 22-year administration. His apology is generating mixed reaction. Some say it is regrettable for victims of human rights violations to wait for 27 years for Mr. Jammeh to utter those words. Others, however, say it was important for the former president to apologize, contending that it forms part of the effort to reconcile the country. Coach Pa Sambajau is a leading Gambia political activist in the Washington, D.C. area. He tells me that the former president's apology does not appear to be genuine.
Because Jammeh is not a sincere guy. He's not an honest guy. He's a sociopath, one of the most dangerous people that you'll ever deal with. So whatever he says to me, I take it with a grain of salt. I don't trust anything that comes out of Jammeh's mouth. So to me, sincerity and Jammeh do not mix. They are not the same. They can never be in the same sentence.
He also came out against the alliance between his party and that of President Adama Barrow, just a few months ahead of the elections, dissolving the executive council and all that. What do you make of this latest development?
That is Jammeh 101. Jammeh is erratic, unpredictable. I think he is just trying to demonstrate that he is still in control, and that is what has happened. But again, this also shows Adama Barrow that you cannot make a deal with the devil, and you cannot allow political expediency to overtake common sense, because it is very sad that Jammeh remains relevant in our politics today, not because of anything, but because of Adama Barrow. because of Aroboros' desire to continue to be president to the extent that he would do anything to appease anyone. So this is a big embarrassment for Adama Barrow, and I hope that he would learn from this experience to at least embrace the victims of Jammeh, because since coming to power, if there's one thing that is constant is that Adama Barrow has stayed away from the victims. He doesn't mention them. He doesn't talk about them. He didn't care about them. All in the interest of trying to appease Yahya Jammeh, get his supporters to now get this reaction from Jammeh.
But coach, hasn't he made efforts to reconcile the country? There was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was set up trying to unite the country.
Well, setting up the TRRC is one thing, and that is not only the doing of Adama Barrow, but something that the coalition had agreed to, and it happened during the early days when the international community were also a little bit influential in what was happening. We had an attorney general who was interested in it. So you cannot give everything to Adama Barrow. But the issue here is, if Adama Barrow had established, his government had established the TRRC and supported it without undermining it, then that would be one thing. But how interesting it is that you set up a TRRC, evidence after evidence coming out against the APRC and Yahya Jammeh committing heinous crimes against the people, only to turn around well before the report is out to go and form an alliance with that same party, with that same leader. To me, so somebody who does not care, it does not show good faith. So I think that Barrow's greed for power has overshadowed his thinking. So I would not give him credit just because of a TRRC is established. If he had shown any goodwill towards the TRRC by at least showing some semblance of respect to the victims, because this alliance with the APRC under the leadership of Yahya Jammeh, who is the supreme leader of the APRC, is nothing but a slap in the face of the victims. So to give him credit for what? For disrespecting the victims? No.
Now, coach, what do you make of the former president's decision to have his new interim APRC leadership form an alliance with Sheikh Tidjane Haidara, the former justice minister? What weight does it carry? And will that give former justice minister the momentum ahead of the December presidential election?
No, it will not. First of all, this is a guy that most people did not. Most people had even forgotten that there was a party called GANU. Of course, to the few APRC supporters, especially those in the Fonyi area, they would support him. But that's where it would stop, because I don't see any way that he would have a lot more momentum than the NPP or the UDP or DOI or GDC. No, it's not. Or even SFR. I don't see it meaning anything at the end of the day. It's just Jammeh trying to show, you know what, I am in charge. And even the manner in which he did it, to me, reminds me of December 9th, 2016, when he came and said that he was annulling the elections and was going to appoint a new IEC and all that. This is Jammeh 101. So it will not mean anything in terms of electoral results.
Coach Pa Sambajao is a leading Gambian political activist. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. In Zambia, President Hakainde Hichilema has appointed Silumesis Muchula as the acting director general of the Anti-Corruption Commission. It comes after the former head of the anti-graft agency resigned. It also comes as Zambians demand an independent inquiry into allegations of corruption in the previous administration. Critics say there is evidence to show that senior government officials of the previous government engage in acts of financial malfeasance. But supporters say the accusations are politically motivated to embarrass the former officials as well as to make the opposition party unpopular for future elections. Meanwhile, anti-graft crusaders are calling for institutional reforms to empower the Anti-Corruption Commission to do its job effectively and without political interference. Nalucha Ziba Nganga is the country director for Action Aid. She tells me that the appointment of the new interim anti-graft commission head does not meet her organization's expectations.
Our reaction to the appointment is that it falls below our expected standard, in the sense that the Anti-Corruption Commission for a long time has not had a substantive director general due to incapacitation of the substantive director general.
on health grounds, and therefore, even the previous one who had been relieved of her duties, she was more in an acting interim capacity for years, and then the tradition and training seems to be continued even with the Ichirema administration. And our view is that it has also helped to weaken the fight against corruption in our country, as we have seen very low prosecution levels when it comes to issues to deal with corruption, especially where you have politically exposed individuals as well as politicians. And largely this is due to the lack of leadership at the Anti-Corruption Commission.
Nalucha, some people are suggesting that sometimes the fight against corruption must be careful, especially when people misconstrue it and say they are politically motivated and their political enemies are being targeted and all that. The president has also said that he wants an anti-corruption that will be run professionally. How do you respond to that?
Well, our response is that in the first place, we need to have institutions that are independent in terms of their function. But what we tend to see with most prosecutory wins in our country, the level of independence and autonomy is not that much enhanced, largely due to circumstances in terms of protection of tenure of office of the people who have those institutions, and also mostly they still largely remain political appointees of whoever is in state house. So we are too far from reaching that level as a country, and that's where we are hoping we would be heading in that direction, going by the pronouncement of the current government and regime. However, they still need to address the institutional challenges and weaknesses that the anti-corruption has when you look at its capacity to fight corruption. And reasons why we say so is if you look at our Auditor General's report, which is also a government entity, which audits all spending agencies as well as government ministries, for 5 years, all of the audits have been in red successively, even the ones which have come up this year. And you find that even government lost a lot of money through procurement, which were happening. And most of the companies that were engaged to procure, all of them, most of them have got politically exposed individuals behind them linked to politicians.
Bringing the Anti-Corruption Commission under the presidency, some people are saying that will give it more muscle. Others are saying that now there will be a political influence to go after those perceived political enemies or rivals. What is your take?
Our understanding is that it was already moved to the office of the president by the previous regime through a government gazette they issued, I believe, in 2019. And the only amendment to that gazette is that the Drug Enforcement Commission has also been moved to the office of the president, so that the Anti-Corruption Commission, the Financial Intelligence Center, as well as the Drug Enforcement Commission are all falling under the office of the president. If that was an issue, we needed to have raised it in 2019 under the Edgar Lungu administration. Nevertheless, however, one of the things we need to question is this agency has been under the office of the president, and we have seen its inefficiencies, and its abilities and capacities have always come into question in terms of fighting corruption. So should it still need to be placed under the office of the president? For us, that's the conversation and discussion we need to be having as a country.
Where do Zambians go from here, particularly with their demand for the investigation and prosecution of public officials and senior government officials who are accused of corruption? Because some people are saying that sometimes it's a political tool to accuse government officials of engaging in acts of corruption, but with little to no evidence to prove that assertion. What do you say to that?
Well, we have seen over the years also weaknesses in terms of the National Public Prosecutions Authority, where even 2 weeks ago there was a case where they failed to bring the court files to court. And we've seen that usually institutions of government, when it comes to politicians, there's a way they just never have the evidence. The way to address the issue we really deal with serious governance reforms in this country, including reforms of the judiciary, reforms of the institutions that deal with issues to do with corruption, law enforcement agencies, and so on.
Nalucha Ziba Nganga is the country director for ActionAid. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Cameroonian peace activist has been shortlisted as a finalist for the United States Institute of Peace, or USIP Women Peace Building Award 2021. Esther Omam Njomo is the founder and executive director for Reach Out Cameroon. It's a women and youth-focused NGO working to restore peace in the Central African country and broaden conflict between separatists and soldiers from the National Army. Ms. Omam Njomo, in 2018, formed the Southwest Northwest Women's Task Force. It engaged over 150 women leaders to help start peace talks aimed at restoring peace in the Anglophone parts of the country where conflict rages. Reach Out has been training women to become peace mediators in their communities. The program forms part of the effort to help resolve the ongoing conflict in the mainly English-speaking parts of the country. Ms. Omam Njomo says the women who participate in the training have been significantly impacted by the conflict. The USIP award, which coincides with the International Day of Peace, is given annually to a woman who has contributed to ending conflict in her country. For reaction to being among the finalists for the USIP Women Peace Building Award, I reach Esther Omam Njomo from Boya, capital of Cameroon Southwest Region.
My reaction after the good news about my nomination as among to be one of the 10 finalists in the upcoming award was that of extreme joy. It was so unexpected, and people rushed to my office thinking that something bad has happened to me. My collaborators were asking, "What is it?" I couldn't say a word. I just pointed to the screen of my laptop. Innocent civilians are dying. 2 days ago, a little child of 4 years was shot, the brain scattered, while she was going to school in the mother's car. What did she do? Nothing wrong than to long to go to school. That same school we, the women, have been advocating for, that we allow, that should allow access for education to our children. Yes, that child died. Thousands went to the street, and I had to go in solidarity with other women to stand by the grieving mother. Truly, it is now that the work begins. This is what this award symbolizes to me. You agree with me, Peter, that there would be no need for any award if there was no conflict. Awards come as a result of crisis, conflicts, people dying. Girls being raped, people being maimed, villages razed, livelihoods destroyed. Yes. And because we, women peace builders and mediators, stand to speak out, to denounce, to advocate, to plead, to educate, we get to the level where we are today for recognition of the work done. And that recognition comes with so much responsibility. And one of such is continuity of the work we started already.
If you were to win this award, what would that do to your efforts in trying to bring peace? Because I heard reports that sometimes you feel threatened by both sides of the conflict.
If I happen to win this award, Peter, it will serve as a form of protection to my person and my family. Remember that my children had been kidnapped. My family have been threatened to gunpoint, and my collaborators kidnapped. Our humanitarian car burnt, and many other orders happening to us. So if I win this award, it's going to reinforce protection, increase visibility of the work that we are doing, and ensure that recognition for the work that we're doing get to a higher level and to majority of the people we are serving to stand also for us.
What impact do you anticipate this having on the work you are doing, especially with those who you are training, the women groups that you are training to carry out peace activities to bring peace to their respective neighborhoods engulfed in the ongoing conflict?
It will make them regain the lost hope, increase their self-esteem, make sure that there is trust among the womanhood, the sisterhood that we represent in carrying out our activities. It will galvanize their efforts in doing more than what we have been doing before, and it will take us to all the remotest parts of the communities to preach peace. It will enable us to carry out our community strengthening caravan, which we've started already, to strengthen community systems in order for them to live in peace while building social cohesion.
Esther Omam Njomo is the founder and executive director for Reach Out Cameroon. She spoke with me from Boya, capital of Cameroon's Southwest region. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, the National Museum of National Science and History plans to hold an event aimed at promoting public awareness of the contributions and breakthroughs made by nuclear science and its contributions to the world. National Science Week is an international event which will be held in Washington, D.C. The program that begins on October 18 to 22 will also underscore the importance of NASA's 60th anniversary award. Nuclear science experts, local and state representatives, and the public are expected to participate in the event. Officials say there will also be information on carbon-free energy, global leadership, transformative healthcare, innovation and technology, as well as space exploration. For more about the week-long event and how nuclear energy can help to reduce fossil fuel emissions and promote job opportunities, I reached Jennifer Hayden, Deputy Director and Director Communications at the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History.
The National Museum of Nuclear Science and History, we are located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we've been around for about 52 years. We tell the story of the atomic age, from early developments such as the Manhattan Project and Cold War to today's peaceful uses of nuclear energy and nuclear medicine. And it was about 12 years ago that our executive director and other people within the nuclear industry started talking about wanting to have more kind of an educational outreach to our communities to tell people about nuclear science, really the benefits of them and the men and women who work in nuclear every single day. And we wanted to create a celebration of that. And it was in 2009 that we created National Nuclear Science Week, just to celebrate nuclear science and everyone who works in it. And over the many years that we've been doing it, this is our 12th year, it has expanded so much into different countries and all over the nation that we took off national. And so now it is just Nuclear Science Week that is celebrated in various cities, in different little towns, countries, even all over the world.
So talk to me about the planned highlights to be unveiled during this year's Nuclear Science Week event, including NASA's 60th anniversary award.
Absolutely. So every year since its inception in 2009, a big event, a national event held in the United States does take place in a large city somewhere around the nation. This year, it is going to be in Washington, D.C., which it has been held in D.C. a couple of times prior. And we do now host an award that is a Lifetime Achievement Award. And because NASA contributes so much to the nation in definitely using nuclear technology, the Lifetime Achievement Award this year is being given to NASA. Now, we have, when we do a large event like this, it usually is a culmination of a variety of different events. This one, Nuclear Science Week, it always takes place the third week of October every year. And with this, the big events, it will be taking place Tuesday, October 19th through Thursday, October 21st. But the entire event really is taking place the 18th through the 22nd.
So, Jennifer, in what ways do you think nuclear science continues to play an integral role in the world's plan to create a clean energy future, particularly those in the developing world, perhaps some African countries as well?
So when it comes to the future uses, and I don't usually share opinions other than the fact that it is very much obviously a carbon-free energy source. And that's why we do reach out through Nuclear Science Week to go over the five pillars of nuclear science. Carbon-free energy is, of course, huge. And I do, and this is my opinion, I do believe that that could be something that could very much help communities worldwide with necessary energy sources. We also, another of the five pillars would be global leadership, which is often the Navy, different other sources such as that. There's transformative health care. Then there's innovation and technology. And of course, lastly, space exploration. So that's why so many people within the nuclear industry utilize Nuclear Science Week, the 1 week celebration every year focusing on nuclear, to tell their stories, who they are within those five pillars, whether it's energy or leadership or healthcare or space exploration. This is the time where they can host events that are for their communities, maybe for their schools. Here in Albuquerque at our museum, we host field trips into our museum. Because of COVID, and we are trying to be very thoughtful of that, we're doing virtual events through the museum to reach out to community members. It is free, and we just try to get to as many people as possible who would want to learn more about nuclear, energy, science, everything in general.
Briefly talk to me about how you expect the program this week to go in Washington, D.C.
Oh, sure. We're very optimistic. I mean, these are very, they're very almost informal celebrations in Washington, D.C. The first night is on Tuesday, October 18th. And with that event, it is more of a thank you event for our sponsors. So many different people within the nuclear industry have come together to contribute to Nuclear Science Week and having these events in D.C. So that event will be lovely. It is something, again, just a thank you night and also recognition of NASA for the Lifetime Achievement of Nuclear Award. Then Wednesday on October 20th, it will be an evening on the Hill. And this one really is more towards the staff members on the Hill. We want to introduce nuclear in a very vivid, sensory engaging type atmosphere to where people can come into this event and learn more about nuclear, especially energy, medicine, all of the different five pillars. And then on Thursday, that is where we focus a lot on some of the maybe incoming talent that will be coming into the future of nuclear. So this is happening. It's almost like a nuclear industry speed mixer event where we've invited colleges, university students, interns, anybody who is interested within the nuclear field, STEM in general, but definitely nuclear. They're invited to come to this event. All of these events are definitely free for anyone who is attending, but Wednesday and Thursday are very much open to the public. And Thursday, just by going to nuclearscienceweek.org, you are able to RSVP, because that one we're trying to get a little bit better gauge on how many people will be attending. But truly, just an opportunity to engage the public and speak a little bit about nuclear to have a fun, engaging kind of educational experience.
Jennifer Hayden is Deputy Director and Director Communications at the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. She spoke with me from New Mexico in the U.S. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpunga. Hello, Douglas.
Hey, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, on Tuesday, Morocco and Senegal became the first teams to reach the African playoffs for next year's World Cup in Qatar. The two made it through with two group games left. The playoff in March will determine Africa's five representatives in Qatar. Only eight other group winners will join Morocco and Senegal in the playoffs. Egypt need 3 points from their final two matches against Angola and Gabon to progress to the next stage of qualifying. However, Libya could still qualify if they win their remaining games and Egypt fail to win their matches. In Group B, Tunisia has a 3-point lead over Equatorial Guinea, and an away win against Equatorial Guinea will be enough. In Group A, Africa Cup of Nations holders Algeria are ahead of Burkina Faso on goal difference alone, with the two countries meeting in Algiers after they face Djibouti and Niger, respectively. In Group D, Ivory Coast lead Cameroon by a point. If both win their next matches, Ivory Coast and Mozambique, and Cameroon taking on Malawi, then Cameroon will need to beat Ivory Coast at home to progress. Also in Group G, South Africa have a one-point advantage over Ghana, and the two meet in the final round in Ghana. Nigeria are 2 points ahead of Cape Verde in Group C. Nigeria host Cape Verde in the final round of the group stage. And in Group E, Mali and Uganda remain unbeaten, with the West Africans leading the Cranes by 2 points. They also meet in the final game with Mali, the home team. And three countries are fighting for top spot in Group I. Tanzania and Benin both have 7 points, while DR Congo are 2 points behind the pair. Meanwhile, Zambia, Central African Republic, Gabon, and Madagascar can still mathematically qualify, but they need to win their remaining two games and hope other results go their way. And 17 teams have been eliminated. They are Angola, Togo, Congo, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Guinea-Bissau, Liberia, Kenya, Malawi, Mauritania, Mozambique, Namibia, Niger, Rwanda, Sudan, and Zimbabwe. In athletics, Athletics Kenya, the sports governing body in the country, on Thursday suspended all athletics competitions for 2 weeks as a mark of respect for Agnes Tirop. Tirop, a record-breaking long-distance runner, was stabbed to death at her home last week. Police in Kenya have arrested her husband, Ibrahim Rotich, who will face charges once investigations are completed, according to a Kenyan police official. Tirop, who was 25, was found dead on Wednesday in the western town of Iten. Last month, she broke the women's only 10 kilometers road race world record. During her career, she won the junior 5,000 meters bronze at the World Championships in 2012 and 2014, and as a senior, she won the World Cross Country Championships in 2015. In August, she finished fourth in the 5,000 meters final at the Tokyo Olympics, and in 2017 and 2019, she won the 10,000 meters bronze at the World Athletics Championships. In September, she broke the women's only 10-kilometer road race record by 28 seconds in Germany, setting a new time of 30 minutes and 1 second. Finally, Basketball Africa League qualifiers have been confirmed. FIBA Africa announced on Monday the draw results of the qualification round for the second edition of the Basketball Africa League. The first round of the qualifiers will be held from October 19th to 31st in four African cities, that is Conakry in Guinea, Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, Johannesburg in South Africa, and Yaounde in Cameroon. A total of 26 African teams have registered and have been divided into six groups, with 13 teams competing in the West Division, while 12 teams will do battle in the East Division. Egypt's Zamalek won the first edition. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As expected, President Kenyatta of Kenya presided over sessions of the Security Council last week. He had already promised during the presidency of Kenya for the month of October, Kenya would put forward significant programs for the Security Council to tackle. Already by mid-October, we see a revival of activities in the Security Council, and we hope that this will continue to the end of October when Kenya's presidency comes to an end. President Kenyatta also used his time at the United Nations to pay a visit to Washington for an audience with President Biden, thus becoming the first African states to be received by the American presidency in the White House. From all reports, it seems that the meetings between President Biden and Kenyatta was cordial and that they tackled a number of pressing disputes. This is characteristic of the long relationship between Kenya and the United States, particularly in the security field, where Kenya and the U.S. have been cooperating to deal with terrorism in Somalia and also in the Indian Ocean. Returning to the United Nations, the Kenyan presidency has urged activity to resolve once and for all the issue of Western Sahara. Obviously, he was disregarding the decision of former President of the United States to recognize the sovereignty of Morocco in Western Sahara. He felt that this is a matter of very strong importance to the African Union and highlighted the fact that the Polisario Front is a member of the African Union and that the African Union considers the issue of Western Sahara as a matter of self-determination. Perhaps it's because of this urgency that was being expressed by the Kenyan president that we saw the appointment of the chairman or representative of the Secretary General on Western Sahara. The post has been long been vacant since the last representative resigned. It is also known that the Secretary General had proposed a new candidate, which the Polisario accepted, but Morocco long delayed its response. Now, with some pressure, perhaps, Morocco has accepted the candidate, and that new candidate has been announced in New York last week. President Kenyatta also made it clear that the issue of Ethiopia and Tigray should be resolved within the confines of the African Union. He felt the same way as President Prime Minister Abiy of Ethiopia. And here we must take into account that prior to his visit to New York and Washington, President Kenyatta had gone to Addis Ababa for consultation with the Prime Minister. Now one has to see what would be the reaction. No reports have been made as to whether the issue of Tigray was discussed by the United States and the President Kenyatta, because the United States has taken a very firm stand on the issue of the dispute, and all reports show that there is a conflict with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, who had rejected many of the intervention of the United States and of those of the Western powers in particular. What we now can detect is a revival of what this commentator once dubbed the Congo allergy, which was the posture of the founding fathers of the African regional group when their over-reliance on the United Nations was disappointed by the death of Prime Minister Lumumba and the failure of the United Nations to end the secession in Katanga. And this, in fact, led to the formation of the OAU, and they said that disputes in Africa must be resolved by the Africans themselves and not by outside powers, because of the fear that when outside powers intervene to resolve disputes in Africa, it becomes contentious, and in the end, the Africans would suffer. And when this principle actually was challenged in November 1964, when Belgium and the U.S. tried to rescue those in Stanleyville, the Africans challenged this issue in the Security Council that year, and the Security Council did adopt a resolution which says that Africa should be given the opportunity to resolve African disputes. But over the years, this principle has fell apart, And we now see that many African issues are resolved without adequate African participation. So these things are now being tested. Prime Minister Abiy of Ethiopia, for example, on the Grand Renaissance Dam, also is insisting that this is a matter not for the security of the Council or any outside powers, but for the organization of the African Union. This, of course, causes problems, because in the case of Tigray has doubts about whether it could get any kind of resolution within the African Union, and Egypt in particular does not feel that it could find good solution under the African Union, even though both Egypt and Sudan are members of the organization. So what Africans should watch carefully for is whether this tendency for the resurgence of the Congo allergy would result in the African Union being more active and insisting that it participates when the issue of Africa is being discussed, either within Africa or outside Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
You sweet like a peeping mama. I can't fight, I can't kill someone for you. Because I'm in the danger zone. Oh no. This feeling. Thank you.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Bill Eager, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, one camel does not make fun of the other camel's hump. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.